This is News in No Time, Tony Cox. And now for an update on a harrowing story we brought you several months ago. In October of last year, 20-year-old Megan Williams was found captive in a trailer in West Virginia. She had been stabbed, sexually assaulted, and forced to eat animal feces. Seven people were charged with various crimes in the case. This week, 46-year-old Karen Burton, who is white, pleaded guilty to a hate crime and other charges related to the kidnapping and torture of Williams, who is black. Burton is the only one of seven charged with a hate crime. That's our first story on today's Reporters Roundtable. Joining us are Bob Butler, an independent journalist and president of the Bay Area Black Journalists Association, Sean Gonzalez, assistant news editor for the Cape Cod Times, and Gary Harkeye, a reporter for the Charleston Gazette. Welcome to all of you.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Gary, let's start with you because you've been covering the Megan Williams story from the start. We mentioned at the top of the show that Karen Burton was the only one charged with a hate crime. Why is that?
It's just due to the specific facts of the case. And in her case, they had a situation where she stabbed Miss Williams as she called her a racial slur. And that alone allowed them, in that one specific instance, to say that it was a hate crime. There were other cases where Karen Burton had abused Miss Williams. She choked her with a cord, hit her, slapped her, where she was not charged with a hate crime. She was charged with, I believe it was malicious wounding. But based upon that, it was, in that case, she had, her motive was to infringe upon Ms. Williams' civil rights, which allowed them to charge her with a hate crime.
Now, we know that Williams had a social relationship with these people before this attack. Megan's mother did not initially report her missing because she had been gone for long periods of time before. And to follow that point, the victim is also described as having issues of mental competence. Does any of that complicate this case in any way?
It's all... What you have is you have seven people, and each of them had their own motives for doing this, doing what they did to her. Bobby Brewster, who was the man that she had some sort of relationship with beforehand. Frankie Brewster was his mother. She actually got Bobby Brewster put in jail back in July, and his motive, according to the prosecuting attorney, is, you know, his motives were basically revenge upon her for putting him in jail. So every time they would get drunk or start partying, she would be there, and he would say, you know, you put me in jail, and then attack her.
So there are still some remaining defendants to be tried or adjudicated or pleaded out in some way.
Yes, there's four people left that have not pled guilty yet, and it's hard to tell whether or not they will plead guilty or go to trial. Bobby Brewster, Frankie Brewster, Danny Combs, those are the three that had sexual charges against Megan Williams. And also there was a Lenny Burton Jr., who he had not originally been charged but is now charged with one count of misdemeanor battery.
All right. Let's move across country to another story. Bob, I'm going to bring you in to talk about this because you're covering a trial related to the murder of Chauncey Bailey. Chauncey Bailey was an Oakland journalist who was killed allegedly for looking into the inner workings of a bakery in Oakland, California, with connections to the Nation of Islam. Now, I understand that the man accused of Bailey's murder has entered a not guilty plea. What is the latest and what's going on in court today?
Well, today in court, this was actually an unrelated case, unrelated to Chauncey Bailey's murder. People at this bakery, it's called Your Black Muslim Bakery, five of the workers, including the CEO of the bakery, were arrested the day after Chauncey was killed. They were arrested on a kidnapping and assault charge stemming from an incident last May in which they allegedly kidnapped a mother and daughter and then tortured the daughter in an effort to try to find out where a drug dealer kept his money. This was apparently an attempt to get money for the bakery. Now, this happened in May. Police did not make the arrest until August 3rd, a day after Chauncey's death. And what's happening today is the preliminary hearing is supposed to be concluding. It started last week, and there was a big surprise in which one of the defendants pleaded guilty in a very private, secret plea on Tuesday, and then came to court on Friday and announced that he had pleaded guilty and was going to testify against the other four. This has caused much consternation among the bakery people's families, because in this particular case, a lot of these, the guy who's testifying against the CEO and one of the other defendants are all half-brothers. They all have the same father, who was the patriarch of the bakery, and different mothers.
Let me stop you right there. Let me stop you there, because it is hard to follow this, and that leads me to the question that I was going to put to both you and to Gary. And Sean, hold on. I'm coming to you to talk about some things inside the Beltway in just a second. And my question, and the reason I stopped you, Bob, is this. How difficult is it to report information in cases like this in a way that doesn't lose the audience because of the minutiae?
You know, it's difficult. I mean, as reporters, our job is to take very complicated subjects and make them simple enough for our audience to understand. In this case, it's becoming and has been very difficult, because this is a story about a bakery that was once an institution in the city of Oakland that gave jobs to ex-convicts where they couldn't find work anyplace else. It's the story of a man who started the bakery, who became an icon of the community, and then all of a sudden find out that he was facing charges of sexual assault and rape against minors. It's very difficult, because there's so many layers to this story and so many threads, and the more you dig, the more you find, and it's one of those things where they talk about peeling the onion.
Yeah,
well, this is a very, very large onion,
that's
and the
for
more
sure.
we peel, the more we find.
And it is hard to keep, it's fascinating and yet hard to keep up with. Let me bring Sean in here, because we also want to talk about some other stories, because while much of the media have focused on the race for the White House right now, and deservedly so, some other big stories are happening this week inside the Beltway. Waterboarding, torture or not torture? Legal or not legal? Did we do it or did we not do it? Will the U.S. do it again? Well, the White House says maybe, and Attorney General Mike Mukasey says he won't prosecute those who were involved in waterboarding the last time. So, Sean, to you, how much traction does this story have with the public when we are in the midst of war?
Well, it's hard to gauge, I think, because of, you know, it seems like over the past few years, you know, you're just hit with scandal after scandal, and you know, I don't know if folks are weary or it's become acceptable, and sort of the common thread through all the stories we've been talking about is torture. And so it's just a little bizarre and amazing that we've reached a point in this country where, you know, we're talking a lot about torture, and now what's amazing is in yesterday we find that the president actually okayed the use of waterboarding in at least three cases. And it doesn't seem, I mean, it seems like maybe among Obama supporters it does have some traction, which is probably the reason why he specifically mentioned waterboarding in his Super Tuesday speech the other evening.
What about McCain?
And, well, I guess the interesting thing is, I mean, if you assume McCain is the Republican nominee and both the Democratic nominees, it seems like waterboarding when the Bush administration leaves the White House will be coming to an end as a practice. To me, what's really bizarre about this whole thing is just the history of it. I mean, it really comes out of the, the survival, evasion, and resistance escape schools. That's where U.S. military personnel were trained to resist in waterboarding. And one of the things that is pretty accepted among people who are experts in this thing is that these torture techniques were not designed to elicit truthful information, but they're really designed to elicit confessions. And that's what's so disturbing about the waterboarding that's been taking place.
Are you finding, Gary, in your neck of the woods, that this is an issue people are talking about?
To some degree. I mean, I think everyone around here is much more worried about the economy than any other one single issue, the tax cuts.
Mm-hmm. Well, to that end, then, let's talk about this. The House and Senate have approved a $168 billion economic rescue package, which is headed for the president's desk. He is expected to sign it. That means that approximately 130 million Americans should start receiving checks by spring. So what does that mean for the average citizen, Bob?
Well, I think for a lot of people, they're looking forward to getting the money, especially if you don't make a lot of money. But there's a school of thought with some folks that, well, tax cuts are nice, but with the economy being the way that it is, do we really need that? I mean, let's face it, if I get the money, I'll pay a bill, I'll do something. But I think the whole point of these tax cuts is to stimulate the economy. But people are so far behind on their bills right now because of the way the economy is. I think most of this money is going to be used probably just to pay a bill. It's not going to be used to stimulate the economy.
Well, some believe that that is what will stimulate the economy if you spend it on buying something or paying for something. But, Sean, to you, how does this impact the presidential race, if at all, do you think? We've got
well,
about a minute.
I think this whole thing is probably more of a political stimulus than it is an economic stimulus. You know, there actually have been studies. The last time this happened, 2001 rebate, you know, there have been studies that were done with what people actually did with their rebates at that time. And, you know, the studies found that lower-income people spent more of the rebates than middle-income people, but higher-income people spent more than middle-income people. And it also showed that household credit card debt, some of these studies show that household credit card debt immediately dropped after the 2001 rebate. So, like Bob, I think, was saying a minute ago, I think a lot of folks who will get the rebate will probably use it to spend on bills. And whether or not that stimulates the economy, I don't know. Maybe this is more of a transfer of wealth to, you know, utility, mortgage, and credit card companies.
Well, look for your check to be in the mail sometime in May, according to the Treasury Secretary. Gentlemen, thank you very much, Bob, Gary, and Sean.
Thank you.
Bob Butler is an independent journalist and president of the Bay Area Black Journalists Association. He joined us on assignment in North Carolina. Sean Gonzalez is assistant news editor for the Cape Cod Times. He joined us from his home in Hyannis, Massachusetts. And Gary Harkeye is a reporter for the Charleston Gazette. He spoke with us from his office in Charleston, West Virginia.